Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. We're here on Family Matters, and I'm Jill Ajizi. Thank you for listening. We appreciate you all so much. As many of you know, a couple of months ago, I was elected president of Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, something that I've been working very hard to try to eradicate, if that's possible, all across the nation and all around the world. So this show has been sort of dedicated to that theme, and sometimes we vary from that, but today I'm so excited, and I'm missing my wonderful co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence, today. Of course, she's working while we're taping this show today and is on the bench in Cook County, Chicago, Illinois, doing great, great work, revolutionary in her courtroom in what she does with divorcing families and especially with children. Her dedication is to change the lives of children all across Illinois, and specifically the ones that come in front of her bench. So we are missing Michelle today. And, of course, her great book, The Good Karma Divorce, was released in January, and it is doing so, so well. And she is doing seminars based on the book all over Illinois and all over the country. If you're interested in booking her, please let our show know, or you can give me a call, find me on the internet, and I can connect you. But today, let's get to our guest at hand, and that is my friend, Dr. Saul Goldstein. Welcome, Saul.
Thank you for having me.
I am so pleased to have you here. We had to move our taping that we had scheduled, and I was so disappointed the other night. But as you know, I was on the Dr. Phil show the other day, and we finally had an air date, and it happened to fall on the same day that we were going to tape our show. So I was so disappointed not to talk to you the other day, but pleased that you have the time to be with me today. Thanks.
I'm happy to be here. And you know what?
Well, I want to talk today. First of all, I want you to tell me. I mean, you have such an amazing CV, and there's no sense in running down everything that you've done because it would take the entire hour just to talk about your credentials. So I just want you to tell our listeners why you're involved specifically with parental alienation and some of the most recent things that you're doing in that arena.
Well, I'm a child psychiatrist who's been practicing for, 40-odd years, and we look at what we can prevent and areas where we can be forerunners in prevention of illness and problems, which will later show up in adulthood. And this is one case where we know that there is a noxious factor working on children that will produce quite often problems in the future. And it's something that can be prevented, should be prevented, must be prevented at any cost. And I thought this is what I should be doing. And so in my retiring years almost, I'm saying this is what I'm going to devote my life to.
And you are really dedicated to this. And you're right now, you and your wife are writing a book, right? Are you in the middle of authoring something?
We were in the middle of authoring a book, and we got so involved with doing this work that that's taken a back burner. But that book was going to be about how to raise children and how to raise successful children, and it was going to be entitled Do As I Do and I Will Not Have to Say.
I like it.
Yeah, we have to show people examples of how to be solid citizens, and they will learn from us. We don't have to tell them what to do.
Well, and solid citizens is definitely what we need. We need to get back to having whole, solid citizens in Canada, where you are, and in the United States, and all around the world, because it seems like to me, and maybe you feel differently, but I think common sense has left most people.
That's the worry, that the common sense and dealing rationally and in a nice way with one another goes by the wayside when we start pursuing our own interests, our own be for me and nobody else. Not good. Doesn't work.
Yeah, you can't be selfish. You can't be spoiled. You got to look out for other people and treat them the way that you want to be treated, I think, is the basis for all of this. But let's talk about, for people who are listening, why don't you just give me your basic definition of what is parental alienation?
Parental alienation is really really almost a kaleidoscope or a whole spectrum of events that go on when parents are divorced or separated from one another, or are living under the same roof and married to one another, but separated in their ideology, where one parent places the children in a spot where they have to choose between them and the other parent, and puts them in the position where they have to denounce that other parent, the other parent's values, the other parent's friends, the other parent's families, at the expense of the child's well-being.
And when you say it can happen in intact marriages as well, I think people aren't really, you know, they think you have to be in a divorce situation for this to happen. And that's not really true, is it?
Not really. It happens when people feel that they can use children to get at the other person. And that's a horrendous sin against those children, because it's really the worst form of abuse. It's abuse that does not show scars visibly, does not produce bruises or blood. It's something that goes on inside the psyche, inside the person's well-being, inside the person's sense of self. And I'm talking, when I say person, inside the child. And that's just unforgivable abuse.
So when this occurs, when parental alienation occurs in or out of a marriage setting, in a divorce setting, what happens to the child?
Well, my way of thinking with it is that aside from what everybody has described, like the big names in this field who've done all the writing, I think that child's psyche is affected. Because every human being is a combination of their two parents, the father and the mother. And we have ideals of them, and we have pictures of them, and they are incorporated into ourselves as beings. So we're all partially father, partially mother. When mm-hmm. When the child is put into the position of having to choose, they are asked to destroy a part of their own personality, to destroy reality as they perceive it, and give in to that and adopt the reality of the person whom they are feeling threatened by, in a way that if they do not do that, they will lose that person.
When you just said that, destroying their own personality, my heart just sank and tears came to my eyes, because I thought of the amazing personality that my daughter Elizabeth and my son Thomas had when the last contact that I had with them. And it just, it's heartbreaking to me that that personality is no longer there. And if they do decide to come back, that person that I knew isn't there anymore. And do you think that it is probable that with some sort of counseling or reunification process that you can get that back, Saul?
I think that you can, with the proper treatment and reunification process. And sometimes, very, very rarely, we used to think that it would happen all the time, the children will come back spontaneously when they reach a stage where they start to evaluate the world on their own. But, you know, what we're seeing more and more is that they become stunted and they go on and cannot evaluate the world properly. So that if somebody shows them something and says, this is what you have to believe, this is what you end up believing, and you don't question, you don't use your own judgment, you don't use or appreciate your own perception.
Yesterday, I had a conversation with a dear friend of mine who is a news anchor on the television station here, and Mary Ann said to me, she is an adult survivor of parental alienation, a very horrible campaign by her mother for Marianne and her brothers and sisters to hate her father. And Marianne finally developed a relationship with her father and has a great relationship with him today. But she's 47 now, and she said to me yesterday, I wish that I could speak to children who are going through this now to let them know it's okay to speak up, that you can say, no, Mom, I love my dad, and I want to be with him, and I want to have a relationship with him. She said she felt for so long so frightened to speak up, and she didn't. And she said she's so sorry about that now. But she said it's as simple as this. Even today, when a friend asked her to go to a movie and another friend asked her to go to a party on the same night, she is upset and confused about having to make a decision about where she's going because she was made to choose her whole life. And she said the effects that it had on me, and she's a strong, independent, wonderful woman, but she has lasting effects from what her mother did to her when she was being alienated from her father.
I can tell you that I'm also a psychoanalyst, which I do not do anymore, but when I was doing psychoanalysis, what really got to me was one particular young lady who was, I thought, very brilliant, but could not get through her first year of university because she could not choose in a multiple choice examination, nor could she complete answers in a 4 or 5 question examination, because that would mean making a decision or taking a stance. And finally, after several years of analysis, she was able to reapply and currently has her PhD and is highly successful in what she's doing and quite good at publishing things about children and what happens to them. The inability to make the choice is impossible. I had one young man who was sitting with two parents who were quite divisive, and one was telling him that he had an odor that wasn't so very good, that he should shower, and the other parent was saying that's just your father being over-controlling and over-persnickety and don't pay attention to him. And he chose that he was going to use right guard on the right arm and nothing on the left arm.
Oh, my goodness.
That's the way he was going to resolve this. And this was still when those parents were still, in a way, talking to one another. Now, when you get to the worst degrees of this sort of alienation, where nobody's allowed to speak with one another and where the person is seen as being dead or just scum enough that you can't have anything to do with them, and then that child cannot have any association. And they feel inside that they are that way. And not only that, but if they don't agree with that parent who's alienating them, they're going to be subjected to the same sort of picture.
So how do you... Yeah, I mean, we know that parental alienation is a form of mind control. But how do these children... Why are they so susceptible to this systematic brainwashing? Why do they want so badly to believe the alienating parent and hate the target parent so much? And you know, I think we need to point out, remember that question, but I want to point this out, that it doesn't just stop at the target parent. In about 98% of the cases, it also involves the target parent's family. So grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins are all affected as well.
And also not just those the family, but anybody who agrees with the targeted parent. Like,
sure.
It happens with physicians and dentists and everybody else who has the same point of view as they do.
So how are these children's minds so pliable, and what makes them believe so much?
Basically, most children want to please. It's hard to believe that, but most children want to please their parents and receive the approval of their parents. Now, in the case where one parent is alienated from the family or pushed out of the family, there's a separation, or even within the intact married family, they are they're subjugated or put into a corner. And if you have that situation, they see what happens to the other person. And they see the power of the alienating person and how they treat the one who does not agree with them. And that is to just get them out of there. decimate them, just get them out and make sure that they are no longer available or they no longer count. Well, they see that and they say, my God, I'd better listen to this person and take their stance and agree with them, or I will be placed into the same situation, and I too will be expelled from the inner circle. I too will be made to feel like I'm scum or useless or just not good to anybody. So if
very
I can't,
sad,
if I see,
it?
if I see the threat, I better join the aggressor. You know, join the one who's doing this and stay with them and hope that I'll be fine. And we've seen, you know, we had a Second World War, didn't we? And we saw what one person could do if they get them to either toe the line or be, get into a concentration camp or be otherwise eliminated. You just joined
yes,
and did all kinds of horrific things to other people.
That's a discussion that your friend and mine, Robert, and I had the other day about that very thing. And he said, you know, we were talking about that. And I said to him, how can an entire race of people fall prey to this? And he said, it's exactly like parental alienation. He said, you know, I'm surprised you can even ask that. And I said, well, I understand now since you've made it so clear to me, but it's just, it's mind control is what it is basically, isn't
mind,
it?
Mind control, it's the total control on the one hand. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you tell those children they're so powerful. They have the power to tell that other parent they do not want to see them, do not want to speak with them. They have the power to tell the grandparents, everybody else. It's that's part of the mind control. It's on the one hand, they're given absolutely no power in the face of the powerful parent who's doing the alienating. On the other hand, they have all the entitlement and empowerment that's given to them to go and talk and speak and act against the other parent. They can kick them, they can spit at them, they can clot them, whatever they want to do. And they're fine because they get the approval of the alienating parent. Approval consciously or unconsciously, subtly or not so subtly.
Saul, do you think it's easier to treat parental alienation when it's in the early stages as opposed to when it gets to the point where there's, you know, spitting and kicking and name-calling and then no contact?
Very much. Very much. I think it's got to be grabbed and dealt with early. Early and even in a preventative way when people first separate, to say to them, hey, this is one thing you're not allowed to do. It's interesting also in the Ontario courts, the Section 30 assessment of which parent is to have more time with them or et cetera, then part of that assessment is the ability of the parent to share the children with the other parent. That's a major factor. So if you can get that going right at the beginning, you see that there's a problem there. Wait a second, there should be some sanctions put into place and stop this from going on.
Absolutely. I think through the court system, definitely things should be put in place. Sanctions, court fines, you know, criminal contempt, all kinds of things that can be done through the court system. But what, for people who are listening, what can you do, Saul, if you feel like this is what's happening to you and it's at the very early stages and you could ward off getting to the moderate or severe level? What can you do?
You can try to see where is it coming from? What's causing this? Why is that person so very angry with you? Why do they have to do this to you? And why can they not put the children's needs ahead of their own? And if there's any way of approaching that from a reality and a reasonable point of view, put that into place. And that means sometimes that you have to say, okay, you know what? You're negotiating with the children, but how about can we negotiate around funds instead? Can we do something, almost like bribing them? And sometimes that'll work. If you're going to be satisfied, let me settle in this way and let this not happen. What did it cost for you not to do this sort of thing? Now,
and maybe
said
if you can go ahead.
No, sorry. And I'm saying that's being very optimistic, that hopefully there is going to be somebody who's going to take this into consideration and stop. I have to tell you, with that sort of, I saw one work a few years ago where somebody came in, and it was a lawyer who trusted me somehow, and he said, I've got a lady here whose child is refusing to go see the father, and I would like you to help her to do something with it. And I looked at it, and it was very clear what she was doing. It was very clear that this was starting very early. And my comment to her was, you know what, I'm now disqualified as an assessor, but I will get the lawyer to get an assessment done and point out what's happening. That'll cost you a fortune, and you will likely lose, or you'll be in danger of losing custody of this kid. Or do you settle down right now and deal with the other issues in different ways, but not with this kid in the middle? And it actually worked, but it was a threat. And it makes me think that if the courts would do that more often. You know, there's a book that we use here quite a bit. I think it was David Clark that did it. It's called 1-2-3 Magic, a way of dealing with children who are giving one a rough time, and the children need to have some sort of measure of control placed on them. And it's a 1, then it's a 2, and a 3 means punishment. The courts have to read that book, and the judges have to know that book inside out, because they are dealing with parents who are acting as recalcitrant children, as challenging children.
Well, and Saul, where is that book available? Can you get it on Amazon?
I'm sure. If you give me, well, if there's a break, I'll find it, and I'll get the book, and I'll tell you exactly the name of the
one,
author.
1-2-3 Magic. Okay.
Yeah, 1-2-3 Magic.
You know, And that's something that many of the people who will hear the show and who are listening today can get 1-2-3 Magic and take it down to your family court judges and let them read it.
Yes.
I mean, that's how you can be an activist. That is something so incredibly simple. Spend the $25 or whatever it is to buy the book and get it to your family court judges. It is an amazing form of activism, and so simple and so easy to do. And if everybody and every family court system across this country and Canada did that, think of the impact it would have, Saul.
Yes. That's exactly when I speak to judges in any meeting. That's the book that I recommend, and I say, look at it and say, this is a 1, this is a 2, and now you're in real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And
They do, lawyers as well, and the guardian ad litems and the custody-appointed, you know, court-appointed advocates, and everybody who's in that cottage industry that works around the court system needs to see these things. Absolutely.
Yes.
And the tools that are available, they're there. Magic 1-2-3 is there, and this is the first time that I've heard about it. So I think if we can get these tools out to these people, things are going to change.
Yes, yes.
So let's move on. We were at the mild, talking about what happens at the mild level. If you just found out this is happening to you and you're trying to stave it off and fix it before it gets to the moderate to severe level, if you can't get it to stop, and as we know, parents, ex-spouses who are trying to invoke emotional justice on that other spouse is going to use anything they can, and most of the time they're going to try to use the hearts, minds, and souls of their children as weapons against the other parent. And so if it's gotten to the moderate or severe level, then what?
I think you get a lawyer who's very tough, who's going to get it into court right away, and the courts have to learn to deal with these as an emergency. These are emergency situations. They've got to be stopped right from the beginning. We've learned, you know, I worked for many years in the intensive care unit of a children's hospital, and there are certain things that take precedence. You treat certain things as an emergency. You learn that you have to set everything else aside and deal with that.
Okay.
I don't know other way.
Well, because we know that time is the friend of the alienator. And the more time that alienator spends coaching that child against the target parent, I think the alienation was really complete in about 6 weeks. Who would have ever thought that children could be turned that quickly against an entire group of people, against grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and all friends that they once had. It is amazing to me the pliable state of a child's mind.
Yes, when they are threatened. And the other thing is that quite often it's not just a threat, but the child is put into a position where they become parentified, so that the parent who is doing the alienating presents themselves as the victim. And they are the victim of a terrible parent who's done some terrible things to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the children rise to the occasion. They're going to look after that poor victim parent. And that's a powerful draw for a child who feels that they have to look after the parent who's hurt, and that who's the cause of the hurt? Well, of course, that target parent.
Oh.
It's very, very complicated.
Boy, there's so many. It is complicated. There's so many layers to what goes on in parental alienation, and so many things that these kids have to think about. It just would be mind-boggling.
Yes.
How many children, Saul, do you think, how many children and teenagers in the U.S. and Canada are affected by parental alienation? Do you have any numbers on that?
I really don't, but I can tell you it's in the thousands and tens of thousands.
I have to believe that's true. You know, there's not a day that goes by that I don't come across in person, two or three people that tell me that's what's happening to me. This is happening to my kids, and I am an alienated parent. And it doesn't matter where I am all across this country. It is just rampant.
It's rampant. It's all over the place. And when I said once that this was the scourge of the 21st century, that we're doing this to the youth, and I think it's been going on for centuries. It's always gone on to a certain extent.
Oh, sure.
But now it's so public, and we have to do something about it, because it's they have many more tools to do this with, and the children communicate more with that parent and are controlled more by that parent. I mean, they get the cell phone, and they know that that parent is only as far away as the cell phone, and that's how they're controlled.
Let's get to the $24 million question right now. Is parental alienation and the DSM-5? What are your thoughts, and why are some mental health professionals opposed to the suggestion that parental alienation should be an official diagnosis?
Well, partially they say that a official diagnosis has to show a history over generations, that there's a whole conglomerate of what goes on before something becomes seen as an official diagnosis. It's almost like a whole syndrome has to be there. This is there, but it's a whole strong political movement that keeps it from being accepted. That's number one. Number two, I think when we're dealing with really horrible things sometimes, a defense called denial comes in, and everybody tries to say it isn't there. We don't want to acknowledge it. You look at Sigmund Freud, who was the father of analysis, right, that was supposed to be such a wise guy with such great insights. He denied totally that there was a Holocaust going on and had to be finally rescued at great cost, because he was going to be taken into one of the camps. But he denied it until the last second. And you see denial like this going on all the time. The denial of the smoker who says that this isn't going to get to me. I'm coughing away a bit, but that's not going to get to me. It's denial of terrible things. And this is the same thing. People can't do that to one another. How can... There's enough that goes on with disease and terrible things, and there's assaults that go on, but this could not happen, because it's almost ubiquitous.
How, do you feel that it will be admitted into the DSM-5?
I can't speak for those people. I'm hoping that it will. I'm really hoping that it will, but I don't know. It's too hot a potato to handle at this stage.
It is. Well, Saul, what do you think the ramifications will be for parental alienation if it isn't admitted? Do you think that the opponents and the political opponents that you mentioned earlier are going to ramp it up and say, see, they didn't even put it in the book, and we're right?
Oh, they do, yes. They will do it, and they do it now. There's one famous guy here in one of the cities in Ontario who sees it only as there are no alienators, there are victimized people who are responding to terrible spouses. And everything is the victim spouse, and so they can do anything to protect their children from that horrible spouse. And that person has been very vociferous, and by the way, he will attack any one of my reports free. He'll review it and attack it free of charge. It's that sort of strength that goes with it. But they're the ones who say, "Hey, this cannot be there." And what are doctors doing looking at this stuff anyway? It's a legal issue. Yeah, that'll go on, but it shouldn't stop one from fighting. You should just make the lobby on behalf of children who are being hurt in this way that much stronger.
You know, it's funny. It seems like unless you have firsthand experience, unless it's happening to you, and you know, God forbid that it would happen to any of the opponents of admitting this into the DSM-5. But you know, if it happens to you, you get it, you understand it, and it's hard for me to believe that these opponents don't know somebody who have had it happen to them and have knowledge of it. You know. Personally, because it's happening to so many people, you would think that they would see. I just talked to an opponent who's in Washington, D.C., last week. In fact, she's going to be on my show in a couple of weeks, and we were talking about my experience with parental alienation. And I think that she, you know, she softened a little bit on her views because she understood that, yes, it does happen to women. It's not just a technique used by men against women. It is a horrible thing that's not a gender issue, and it's happening to men and women all over the world.
You know, part of it, I'm glad you brought that up, because part of it is, and this fellow that I was talking about is the one that says it's only women who are victimized that way. But the truth of the matter is it's almost 50-50. And
yes.
And I see something else here that has not yet been described, but I think is there very much, and that is the one who is doing the alienating is the one who feels inferior to the other one and feels that that's the way they can bring them down to their knees. And they will go after them in that way. It doesn't have to be a reality thing, but that their perception is that they are victimized, they are the loser, they are not the one who have the power, and now through the children they can attain that power. So that's a dangerous situation.
Well, it is a very dangerous situation, and I just, you know, any time anyone who's listening encounters one of the opponents to parental alienation and parental alienation syndrome, please speak out to them and try to educate them and let them know that this is something that's happening to everyone. The faces of alienation are varied and just vast. So I'm a face of alienation. You know, there's a man down the street who, you know, it's every economic status. It's, it doesn't know educational boundaries. It's everybody is affected by this. So
yes.
please be aware of that.
Yes, well, I think your audience should be very well aware of it. It's there all over the place. You look to your, well, we were in first year university. The professor used to say, look to your right and look to your left. Only one of the three of you is going to graduate. It's the same way here. You look to your right, you look to your left, somebody there is going to be involved with being alienated from their children.
Yes. I have a question in the chat room, Saul, that I'd like to ask you. Someone is saying they have an alienated son who just responded to a message from her, and he is accusing her of all kinds of things. How does she respond in a way that keeps the door open for her to continue communication with him?
Oof. That's a difficult one to handle. But I can tell you that addressing the issues will not help. Those issues are not the child's issues. They're not her son's issues and or his son's issues. Whoever it is should say to the son, you should not have to be worrying about that. And then depending on the age of the son, if the son, say, 12 years old, say, you should be worried about who's going to win the World Series, who is, what kind of running shoes are you going to get, what's the latest little gizmo that you want to get in the way of a game. That's what you should be concerned about, not these adult things. They are not for you. And not
good
respond
answer.
And not respond and try to change. They've got to be brought back to being children and show the empathy for them, that you feel terrible for them, that they are in a position that they have to accuse them in that way. And not to try to defend oneself, or not to try to say the parent who got you to say that's a terrible parent. I would not badmouth the other parent at all. I would just say, you're in an impossible position, and I feel horrible for you, and I hope that you'll get over this and we'll be friends again.
I always say that if I hear that knock on the door, which I hope for every second of every day, what would I do? You know, would I be anxious? Would I be frightened? Would I not open the door? Of course not. I would open the door, and I think maybe this is the wrong way to think, Saul, and you can tell me because you're the doc, but I think open the door and you go from that moment forward. And I think I would not talk about anything that transpired before that day and try to encourage rebuilding of a new relationship, because I think, as we said earlier, that child that you knew is no longer there, so you have to reacquaint yourself or acquaint yourself with somebody new. So build that new relationship, and then if questions come up about what happened, do you think it's good to answer them at some point?
Well, you know, the first is the exact answers. You take it from that moment on. You take it from the moment where they show up and take them and say, hey, now we can rebuild. How are you? What are you doing? And let's go on today. I would not get involved in answering any of those questions other than to say they did not and should not have concerned you. Those are adult matters, and not that has nothing to do with my being your parent or your being my child. I'm here to help parent you, not to defend myself as who I was and how I was as a spouse.
Good. I like that. I like that. And I think so many parents, I talked to a couple of people, I mean, ever since Dr. Phil was on, we've just had amazing response on the PAAO website and voicemails. And I talked to a couple of people yesterday who were angry with their children for the disrespectful way that they treated them. And I tried to tell this gentleman yesterday, that is not the child that you knew anymore. He is a different boy now. And what he is doing is simply not, you know, what you would expect, of course, and you shouldn't have to, you know, that's the other question. Do you live with the disrespect if you have contact from your kids? How do you handle that if your children are calling you names, spitting on you, kicking you, as you said earlier, because all of those things are part of, you know, a child on the way to severe alienation. So how do you handle that? Do you walk on eggshells around that child? Do you buy them things to make them happy? How do you handle it?
I would try to be, well, you know, let me take it away from that altogether and let you know, there's a Jewish law, apparently, that when a woman is in the middle of delivering her child in the case room, whatever she says to her husband, she is not to be held accountable for. I think that's a very, very reasonable thing. And I always apply that to these kids. These kids are in that tremendous, awful position, under tremendous pressure, and being attacked immeasurably. And so whatever they do, they cannot be held responsible for. And I think that when somebody does a spitting on it and say, I feel bad, Tommy, that that's what you're having to do right now, because that's not the Tommy that I know, and I know that you don't like to do that. And I'd handle it that. And they'll say, I do this. Okay, Tommy, you'll get over what's happening here. You know, when a kid is feeling ill, and physically ill, and they throw up, do we throw them to the floor, or do we absorb? If they get throw up on us, we hold it and we clean them up. It's the same thing here. It's not the kid's
fault.
So
I feel like you, I feel like you are feeding me a dish of matzo ball soup, which I love beyond anything. It's my favorite. And I feel like you are giving me information today that I haven't had anyone vocalize to me before. And as I'm talking to you now as a heartbroken, alienated parent, and, you know, when, boy, you're making me cry today, and I don't like that.
Well, it's a good thing, too, because, you know, you cry for a good reason, but they'll be back.
You're exactly right. But, I mean, when you just said to me, you know, this old Jewish law about the mother in the delivery room is so true. You are so right, and I never thought about it that way. What they're saying to you, they cannot be held accountable for. And as we have said a million times in this last 45 minutes, these are not the kids we knew. So, wow, what a great bit of wisdom.
Well, I
love it. Thank you,
Saul. I appreciate that very much.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, and everybody loves it in the chat room. So good for you. Good on you, as those Australians tell me all the time. Well, Saul, so we've talked about how to stave off parental alienation when, you know, it first begins. We've talked about some of the very few remedies available to you if you have little to no contact with your children. As far as the court system goes, and in Canada, it's a little bit different than it is here in the United States, but how do you think the court system can help parents in the throes of parental alienation, and how do you think it's hindering them?
Okay, I think hindering them, let's start with that first. Hindering them is when it's treated lightly, and they're told a slap on the wrist will help. It doesn't. You cannot negotiate with this person who's doing that. So it's got to be, this is the way it's going to be, and that's all there is to it. You've got to come down firmly right from the beginning with that 1, 2, 3 magic and say, mm-hmm. That's what it's going to be. Or if it's going to be any temporary measure, and let's try another way, and let's try to be easy, and let's try to be reasonable like the rest of us are, or try to be, then a very short period. You've got 2 months to do it in. And if they don't turn around, then the next step comes into place, and it's got to be a heavy-handed dealing with it. And to me, I think nothing helps better than the reversal of custody and the taking the children away from the parent who's doing it. Because if we have a situation where there's any number of things in a medical situation, if there's tuberculosis there, if there's smallpox there, if there's lead poisoning there, you remove the person from the noxious area and you stop what's giving it to them. Because no matter what counseling you can have, 1 hour a day, 1 hour a week, 1 hour a month, if you have somebody coming and you come home to the parent who's doing the same alienating to you, that other person's got all the other time with you. So it just does not work. It's got to be heavy-handed removal and then working towards reconstituting the relationships on both sides. Because we don't want to have children turning around and then reuniting with one parent but not speaking to the other. It's a matter of learning that they can have a relationship with both parents. They got two arms,
so,
two legs, two eyes, two ears. It takes all of that to make something work properly.
Okay, so if that removal occurs, then do you advocate for absolutely no contact with the alienator when those children have been removed to the target parent's home?
Yes, until that parent has been involved in a certain type of therapy and can tolerate having those children be with the other parent. Absolutely no contact, because any of that contact is something that is presented to the child is, look at me, you've been taken away from me, the terrible situation, told you the situation's an awful one, society's an awful one, and your father or your mother has so much power, look what they've done to me now. They've taken you away from me, and I think I'm going to die as a result. Or I'm been so sick, or I'm lying here, one that I had, I'm lying here in the basement without a television set, and all I do is sleep all day and just get up and get some food and then go back to sleep because I can't stand being in this situation. You know, no wonder that kid's going to turn around and go back. There can be no contact with the person who's been doing it or with their allies.
Well, in your experience, how, when something like that happens, when removal happens, how long does it take for those children, just in a typical situation, because we know every child is different, but how long do you think it would take for that child to be in that household under normal circumstances without the alienating parent to come back, to start to be normal, in quotes, again?
Okay, this sounds like an awful thing, but if that alienating parent has not had the treatment and is prepared to go on with the same thing, it's got to be a very, very prolonged period until that alienating parent either learns that they've got to do something different or the children have grown up and matured enough that they can handle it. And I've had a situation where worked very hard with one person for a year and said, okay, it's long enough, let's try. Within 3 weeks, that person had reversed it and had gone back.
Well, because I know, I mean, from dealing with alienators for many years and in my own personal situation, if those children had been removed, that alienating parent, I would think, would become even angrier and be mounting a campaign for when those he or she did have contact with those children again. Would you not think that would be the case?
Absolutely, and it's only the proof that it's not the children that they want to be involved with, but it's the going against the other parent and whoever supports the other parent. You'd think, you know. Yeah, you'd think that they'd go right away. I had one mother who was removed from the children and the children placed with father, and the judge had said, I am supposed to start working with that mother. It was 2 months before she called me. Now, what mother's going to voluntarily be away from the children for 2 months before she even gets started?
Do you think, Saul, that there's any way, this is a question from the chat room again, that if you, the target parent, could try to work with maybe some member of the alienating parent's family to try, you know, if there would be in some alienating parent's families, there seem to be some people that understand what the alienating parent is doing on occasion, not all the time, but do you think it would be a good idea to try to form some kind of bond with that person if you did not have one before and get them to try to work with that parent? Are these people just so incredibly sick that they also need to be in some kind of treatment?
Okay, so there's two things here. I've found in the past that the members of the family or any friends or any acquaintance, if they should try to bring some reason to the alienating parent, they will soon be ostracized as another target. Okay, I can, it's innumerable cases. When I get involved in these, I know that at the end I'm going to be one of the targets too. Mm-hmm. Because that's not going along with that system. The alienating person is really very firm with that. And there's another thing that I'm just now looking at, and that is the alienating parent, if you look in their background, often there's that sort of thing that's gone on in the past, and the alienating parent does not have a very solid and healthy relationship with their own parent. So that's a danger here, too, is it does go in generations.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. It is cross-generational, isn't it? Because you will often see that there was some event or events or prolonged something in these people's childhoods that affected them greatly.
Yes, absolutely. And it is cross-generational. And I think that is what should make it more appealable to the DSM-5 people when they see that it is cross-generational, that it does come from one situation to another. and a person who is well attached to their own parent and feels free to be able to speak positively and negatively to that person and doesn't always have to be obeying, then that person is less likely to alienate.
So when somebody can get to the point where they could have a reunification process put in place in their family dynamic, where do you recommend that people go? If, for example, if we have people listening right now that think maybe they can get their kids into this reunification counseling, where's a good place to go and who would you recommend for that?
Well, in the States, first of all, whom would I not recommend would be people who are going to just counsel and not challenge the children. So you need to have some place that is like an institution for a weekend that they can go to and look and work. And Richard Warshak has Randy Rand in the States. There's several places in the States where they can go. In Canada here, we're just trying to get started, and I'm involved with one group that's just starting. But then there's a lot of opposition to it. It's seen as a quack psychology or stupidity or just as a pop thing that is going to pass. And so it's challenged all along. But it's very difficult to have people accept that this is something that's needed, that it's a very, very serious problem, and there are all kinds of detractors from it. And I hate to say it, for every 10 lawyers, there are going to be one or two who profit greatly by this sort of thing. And they lack a little bit in scrupulousness, and that's what concerns me. And represent your client and do whatever you can and help them with the process. And deny any sort of thing about alienation and deny the syndrome as an entity.
Well, I think you are absolutely right about lawyers. And I think if they would start really concentrating on the best interest of their client and the children instead of the best interest of their practice, we would be making a lot of headway getting divorce out of the courtroom. As my friend Robert Ferrer says in the chat room, is the most important thing. We need to educate these people as to how to have the smart divorce, as my friend Deborah Moscovich says in her great book. So if we can educate these people how to have that smart, friendly, if you will, divorce, if that's possible. And I was under the assumption in my situation that could happen, but clearly it did not. And the only sufferer in the whole thing is the children, if there's children involved.
Yes. If I could just correct the one thing about the lawyers that I was trying to say is that some of them will help the parent, and they see the parent as the client, rather than seeing the important part of that client being a proper parent, and a proper parent will not do that to their children. And
we've
got to help point that out to that parent at the risk of losing the client.
So are there places where if an alienating parent realizes what they've been doing, is it as easy as 1, 2, 3. Is it easy as just saying, I'm going to stop alienating? Or do they need to go somewhere? And are there programs in place for this type of behavior?
Not really at this stage. And that's something that maybe we should look at in the future. But these people are not intent on looking at themselves. It's a disease. It's a disease. Are they ready to go look at it? My findings have been that even after the court rules against them, they still are not ready to look at it. They just say that the court is stupid, that the court erred, and that's going to be challenged once again. I wish there were such a thing as that they would say, suddenly wake up and say, I've got to stop doing it. And you know what? If they woke up and said that, they would stop doing it, and there'd be no problem for the children to run over to the other side and have a relationship with both. Sometimes, you know, the best and the new partner can be I'm the most helpful in a positive way by saying, stop this nonsense, and we can be happy together, and let's have, it's going to be a great relief for us if the other side has the children for half the time, or whatever, then that's helpful, and it'll often help these parents back off. They feel a little happy, contented with the new partner, and they say, hey, you know what, I don't have to fight the old one anymore. But all too often you find them that they'll find a partner who is a cheerleader and help them along in the process, and they find each other.
Yeah, that I find that that happens in most cases. You get the partner who may have been an alienator, or he or she in their previous marriage, and they come in and they help that. They are just helpful in the process, and that is a horrible thing.
That's the horrible thing. Yeah.
Well, we have had a great show. Can you believe that we only have 4 minutes left? We have talked and talked, and I think it has been amazing, and I want to definitely have you back because everybody has such great comments on what you've said, and the insight that you've given me today has been amazing, and I appreciate it so much. I think sometimes I know everything, and I don't. So I just realized that today.
You know what? But when you reach that age that we just spoke about earlier, before the program mm-hmm. started, then you realize how little you do know and how much more there is to know, and we learn from one another.
Well, I think you're brilliant, and I am just so pleased that Robert put us together, and I'm glad that we could finally get our schedules together and get you on here today. Saul, if people want to communicate with you, how do they do that?
Oh, I can give them my telephone number. It's 416- 929-3287, and I would give you email, but I don't know if Robert told you, I'm challenged in that way. I'm old fashioned.
Let's give it anyway, and then Robert can help you.
Okay, then it's in my wife's name. It's RUCHAMA, and then GOLDSTEIN. It's one word. Then Ruhama Goldstein at Gmail. Okay. com.
Got it. Perfect. Well, this has been a great show, and I hope everybody enjoyed listening, and we will have Saul, Dr. Goldstein, on again to talk about some interesting things about parental alienation. And if you have questions for him, I assume that he would be happy to take your calls and give you some more interesting information on this really popular but unpopular subject. It's everywhere, as we said, and we need to try to help children all around this world not have to go through this. Let's guard our most precious commodity, our children, and help their hearts, minds, and souls to be protected. This is Jill Jeezy. You have been listening to Family Matters, and next show we're going to have Dr. Glenn Caddy and Pamela Richardson, who lost her child who was alienated at 16 to suicide. So we look forward to hearing from them, and we'll have the judge, Michelle Lawrence, back at that time co-hosting. So, Saul, you have a great, great evening, and we'll talk to you soon.
And thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thanks so much.
Look forward.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.